on his stomach. He pokes his head and arms into the windy, oil-smelling darkness between floors and replaces the ceiling panel of the fifth-floor office. It's locked up tight. He doesn't expect anyone anyway. He never does. Western States Land Analysts has never had a single customer. But it's better to be safe. Always safe, never sorry. With his fifth-floor office set to rights, Willie lowers the trapdoor in this one. Up here, the trap is hidden by a small rug, which is superglued to the wood, so it can go up and down without too much flopping or sliding around. He gets to his feet, dusts off his hands, then turns to the briefcase and opens it. He takes out the ball of tinsel and puts it on top of the dictaphone, which stands on the desk. "Good one," he says, thinking again that Sharon can be a real peach when she sets her mind to it, and she often does. He relatches the briefcase and then begins to undress, doing it carefully and methodically, reversing the steps he took at 6:30, running the film backward. He strips off everything, even his undershorts and his black knee-high socks. Naked, he hangs his topcoat, suit jacket, and shirt carefully in the closet, where only one other item hangs, a heavy red jacket, not quite thick enough to be termed a parka. Below it is a box-like thing, a little too bulky to be termed a briefcase. Willie puts his Mark Cross case next to it, then places his slacks in the pants press, taking pains with the crease. The tie goes on the rack screwed to the back of the closet door, where it hangs all by itself like a long blue tongue. He pads barefoot naked across to one of the file cabinet stacks. On top of it is an ashtray embossed with a pissed-off-looking eagle and the words, "If I die in a combat zone." In the ashtray are a pair of dog tags on a chain. Willie slips the chain over his head, then slides out the bottom drawer of the cabinet stack. Inside are underclothes. Neatly folded on top are a pair of khaki boxer shorts. He slips them on. Next come white athletic socks, followed by a white cotton t-shirt, round neck, not strappy. The shapes of his dog tags stand out against it, as do his biceps and quads. They aren't as good as they were in Ah Chow and Dong Ha, but they aren't bad for a guy who is closing in on 40. Now, before he finishes dressing, it is time for penance. He goes to another stack of cabinets and rolls out the second drawer. He thumbs rapidly through the bound ledgers there, passing those from late 1982, then thumbing through those from this year, January through April, May through June, July, August. He always feels compelled to write more in the summer. September through October, and at last the current volume, November through December. He sits at his desk, opens the ledger, and flicks rapidly through pages of densely packed writing. There are small variations in the writing, but the essence is always the same. "I am heartily sorry." He only writes for 10 minutes or so this morning, pen scratching busily, sticking to the basic fact of the matter. "I am heartily sorry." He has, to the best of his reckoning, written this over 2 million times, and is just getting started. Confession would be quicker, but he is willing to take the long way around. He finishes, no, he never finishes, but he finishes for today, and puts the current ledger back between those finished and all those yet to be filled. Then he returns to the stack of file cabinets, which serve as his chest of drawers. As he opens the one above his socks and skivvies, he begins to hum under his breath, not, "Do you hear what I hear?" But the doors, the one about how the day destroys the night divides the day. He slips on a plain blue chambray shirt, then a pair of fatigue pants. He rolls this middle drawer back in and opens the top one. Here there is a scrapbook and a pair of boots. He takes the scrapbook out and looks at its red leather cover for a moment. The word "Memories" is stamped on the front in flaking gold. It's a cheap thing, this book. He could afford better, but you don't always have a right to what you can afford. In the summer, he writes more sorries, but memory seems to sleep. It is in winter, especially around Christmas, that memory awakens. Then he wants to look in this book, which is full of clippings and photos where everyone looks impossibly young. Today, he puts the scrapbook back into the drawer unopened and takes out the boots. They are polished to a high sheen and look as if they might last until the Trump of Judgment, maybe even longer. They aren't standard Army issue, not these. These are jump boots, 101st Airborne stuff. But that's all right. He isn't actually trying to dress like a soldier. If he wanted to dress like a soldier, he would. Still, there is no more reason to look sloppy than there is to allow dust to collect in the pass-through, and he's careful about the way he dresses. He does not tuck his pants into his boots, of course. He is headed for Fifth Avenue in December, not the Mekong in August. Snakes and poppy bugs are not apt to be a problem. But he intends to look squared away. Looking good is as important to him as it is to Bill, maybe even more important. Respecting one's work and one's field begins, after all, with respecting oneself. The last two items are in the back of the top drawer of his bureau stack, a tube of makeup and a jar of hair gel. He squeezes some of the makeup into the palm of his left hand, then begins applying it, working from forehead to the base of his neck. He moves with the unconcerned speed of long experience, giving himself a moderate tan. With that done, he works some of the gel into his hair and then recombs it, getting rid of the part and sweeping it straight back from his forehead. It is the last touch, the smallest touch, and perhaps the most telling touch. There is no trace of the commuter who walked out of Grand Central an hour ago. The man in the mirror mounted on the back of the door to the small storage annex looks like a washed-up mercenary. There is a kind of silent, half-humbled pride in the tanned face, something people won't look at too long. It hurts them if they do. Willie knows this is so. He has seen it. He doesn't ask why it should be so. He has made himself a life pretty much without questions, and that's the way he likes it. "All right," he says, closing the door to the storage room. "Looking good, trooper." He goes back to the closet for the red jacket, which is the reversible type, and the boxy case. He slips the jacket over his desk chair for the time being and puts the case on the desk. He unlatches it and swings the top up on sturdy hinges. Now it looks a little like the cases street salesmen use to display their knockoff watches and questionable gold chains. There are only a few items in Willie's, one of them broken down into two pieces so it will fit. There is a sign. There is a pair of gloves, the kind you wear in cold weather, and a third glove, which he used to wear when it was warm. He takes out the pair. He will want them today, no doubt about that. And then the sign on its length of stout cord. The cord has been knotted through holes in the cardboard at either side so Willie can hang the sign around his neck. He closes the case again, not bothering to latch it, and puts the sign on top of it. The desk is so cluttery it's the only good surface he has to work on. Humming, "We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there," he opens the wide drawer above the knee hole, paws past the pencils and chapsticks and paper clips and memo pads, and finally finds his stapler. He then unrolls the ball of tinsel, placing it carefully around the rectangle of his sign. He snips off the extra and staples the shiny stuff firmly into place. He holds it up for a moment, first assessing the effect, then admiring it. "Perfect," he says. The telephone rings and he stiffens, turning to look at it with eyes which are suddenly very small and hard and totally alert. One ring. Two. Three. On the fourth, the machine kicks in, answering in his voice, the version of it that goes with this office anyway. "Hi, you've reached Midtown Heating and Cooling," Willie Shearman says. "No one can take your call right now, so leave a message at the beep." Beep. He listens tensely, standing over his just-decorated sign with his hands balled into fists. "Hi, this is Ed from the 9X Yellow Pages," the voice from the machine says, and Willie lets out a breath he hasn't known he was holding. His hands begin to loosen. Please have your company rep call me at 1-800-555-1000 for information on how you can increase your ad space in both versions of the Yellow Pages and at the same time save big money on your yearly bill. Happy holidays to all. Thanks. Click. Willie looks at the answering machine a moment longer, almost as if he expects it to speak again, to threaten him, perhaps to accuse him of all the crimes of which he accuses himself. But nothing happens. "Squared away," he murmurs, putting the decorated sign back into the case. This time, when he closes it, he latches it. Across the front is a bumper sticker, its message flanked by small American flags. "I was proud to serve," it reads. "Squared away, baby. You better believe it." He leaves the office, closing the door with Midtown Heating and Cooling printed on the frosted glass panel behind him, and turning all three of the locks. AM. Halfway down the hall, he sees Ralph Williamson, one of the tubby accountants from Gerowitz Financial Planning. All the accountants at Gerowitz are tubby, from what Willie has been able to observe. There's a key chained to an old wooden panel in one of Ralph's pink hands, and from this, Willie deduces that he is looking at an accountant in need of a wee. Key on a panel. If a fucking key on a fucking paddle won't make you remember the joys of parochial school, remember all those hairy-chinned nuns and all those knuckle-whacking wooden rulers, then nothing will, he thinks. And you know what? Ralph Williamson probably likes having that key on a paddle, just like he likes having a soap on a rope in the shape of a bunny rabbit or a circus clown hanging from the hot faucet in his shower at home. And so what if he does? Judge not, lest ye be fucking judged. "Hey, Ralphie, what's doing?" Ralph turns, sees Willie, brightens. "Hey, hi, Merry Christmas." Willie grins at the look in Ralph's eyes. Tubby little fucker worships him, and why not? Ralph is looking at a guy so squared away it hurts. Gotta like it, sweetheart. Gotta like that. "Same to you, bro." He holds out his hand, now gloved, so he doesn't have to worry about it being too white, not matching his face. Palm up. "Give me 5. Smiling shyly, Ralph does. "Give me 10. Ralph turns his pink, pudgy hand over and allows Willie to slap it. "So goddamn good, I gotta do it again," Willie exclaims and gives Ralph 5 more. "Got your Christmas shopping done, Ralphie?" "Almost," Ralph says, grinning and jingling the bathroom key. "Yes, almost. How about you, Willie?" Willie tips him a wink. "Ah, you know how it is, brother man. I got 2-3 women, and I just let each of them buy me a little keepsake." Ralph's admiring smile suggests he does not, in fact, know how it is, but rather wishes he did. "Got a service call? A whole day's worth. 'Tis the season, you know." "Seems like it's always the season for you. Business must be good. You're hardly ever in your office." "That's why God gave us answering machines, Ralphie. You better go on now, or you're going to be dealing with a wet spot on your best gabardine slacks." Laughing, blushing a little too, Ralph heads for the men's room. Willie goes on down to the elevators, carrying his case in hand and checking to make sure his glasses are still in his jacket pocket with the other. They are. The envelope is in there, too, thick and crackling with $20 bills. 15 of them. It's time for a little visit from Officer Wheelock. Willie expected him yesterday. Maybe he won't show until tomorrow, but Willie is betting on today. Not that he likes it. He knows it's the way of the world. You have to grease the wheels if you want your wagon to roll, but he still has a resentment. There are lots of days when he thinks about how pleasant it would be to put a bullet in Jasper Wheelock's head. It was the way things happened in the Green sometimes, the way things had to happen. That thing with Malenfant, for instance, that crazy motherfucker, him with his pimples and his deck of cards. Oh, yes. In the bush, things were different. In the bush, you sometimes had to do something wrong to prevent an even greater wrong. Behavior like that shows you're in the wrong place to start with, no doubt, but once you're in the soup, you just have to swim. He and his men from Bravo Company were only with the Delta Company boys a few days, so Willie didn't have much experience with Malenfant, but his shrill, grating voice is hard to forget. And he remembers something Malenfant would yell during his endless hearts games if someone tried to take back a card after it was laid down. No way, fuckwad! Once it's laid, it's played! Malenfant might have been an asshole, but he had been right about that. In life, as well as in cards, once it's laid, it's played. The elevator doesn't stop on 5, but the thought of that happening no longer makes him nervous. He has ridden down to the lobby many times with people who work on the same floor as Bill Shearman, including the scrawny drink of water from Consolidated Insurance, and they don't recognize him. They should. He knows they should, but they don't. He used to think it was the change of clothes and the makeup. Then he decided it was the hair. But in his heart, he knows that none of those things can account for it. Not even their numb-hearted insensitivity to the world they live in can account for it. What he's doing just isn't that radical. Fatigue pants, billy hop boots, and a little brown makeup don't make a disguise. No way do they make a disguise. He doesn't know exactly how to explain it, and so mostly leaves it alone. He learned this technique, as he learned so many others, in Vietnam. The young black man is still standing outside the lobby door. He's flipped up the hood of his grungy old sweatshirt now, and he shakes his crumpled styrofoam cup at Willie. He sees that the dude carrying the Mr. Repairman case in one hand is smiling, and so his own smile widens. "Spare a little?" he asks Mr. Repairman. "What do you say, my man?" "Get the fuck out of my way, you lazy dickhead. That's what I say," Willie tells him, still smiling. The young man falls back a step, looking at Willie with wide, shocked eyes. Before he can think of anything to say, Mr. Repairman is halfway down the block and almost lost in the throngs of shoppers, his big, blocky case swinging from one gloved hand. 10 o'clock a.m. He goes into the Whitmore Hotel, crosses the lobby, and takes the escalator up to the mezzanine, where the public restrooms are. This is the only part of the day he ever feels nervous about, and he can't say why. Certainly nothing has ever happened before, during, or after one of his hotel bathroom stops. He rotates among roughly 24 of them in the Midtown area. Still, he is somehow certain that if things do turn dinky-dow on him, it will happen in a hotel shithouse. Because what happens next is not like transforming from Bill Shearman to Willie Shearman. Bill and Willie are brothers, perhaps even fraternal twins, and the switch from one to the other feels clean and perfectly normal. The workday's final transformation, however, from Willie Shearman to blind Willie Garfield, has never felt that way. The last change always feels murky, furtive, almost werewolfy. Until it's done, and he's on the street again, tapping his white cane in front of him, he feels as a snake must after it shed its old skin and before the new one works in and grows tough. He looks around and sees the men's bathroom is empty, except for a pair of feet under the door of the second stall in a long row of them. There must be a dozen in all. A throat clears softly. A newspaper rattles. There is a pfft sound of a polite little midtown fart. Willie goes all the way to the last stall in line. He puts down his case, latches the door shut, and takes off his red jacket. He turns it inside out as he does so, reversing it. The other side is olive green. It has become an old soldier's field jacket with a single pull of the arms. Sharon, who really does have a touch of genius, bought this side of his coat in an army surplus store and tore out the lining so she could sew it easily into the red jacket. Before sewing, however, she put a first lieutenant's badge on it, plus black strips of cloth where the name and unit slugs would have gone. She then washed the garment 30 times or so. The badge and the unit markings are gone now, of course, but the places where they were stand out clearly. The cloth is greener on the sleeves and the left breast, fresher in patterns any veteran of the armed services must recognize at once. Willie hangs the coat on the hook, drops trow, sits, then picks up his case and settles it on his thighs. He opens it, takes out the disassembled cane, and quickly screws the two pieces together. Holding it far down the shaft, he reaches up from his sitting position and hooks the handle over the top of his jacket. Then he relatches the case, pulls a little paper off the roll in order to create the proper business is finished sound effect, probably unnecessary, but always safe, never sorry, and flushes the john. Before stepping out of the stall, he takes the glasses from the jacket pocket, which also holds the payoff envelope. They're big wraparounds, retro shades he associates with Lava Lamps, an outlaw biker movie starring Peter Fonda. They're good for business, though, partly because they somehow say veteran to people, and partly because no one can peek in at his eyes, even from the sides. Willie Shearman stays behind in the mezzanine restroom of the Whitmore, just as Bill Shearman stays behind in the fifth-floor office of Western States Land Analyst. The man who comes out, a man wearing an old fatigue jacket, shades, and tapping a white cane lightly before him, is Blind Willie, a Fifth Avenue fixture since the days of Gerald Ford. As he crosses the small mezzanine lobby toward the stairs, unaccompanied blind men never use escalators, he sees a woman in a red blazer coming toward him. With the heavily tinted lenses between them, she looks like some sort of exotic fish swimming in muddy water. And of course, it is not just the glasses. By 2 this afternoon, he really will be blind, just as he kept screaming he was when he and John Sullivan and God knows how many others were medevaced out of Dongha province back in 70. "I'm blind," he was yelling it, even as he picked Sullivan up off the path, but he hadn't been exactly. Through the throbbing post-flash whiteness, he had seen Sullivan rolling around and trying to hold his bulging guts in. He had picked Sullivan up and ran with him, clasped clumsily over one shoulder. Sullivan was bigger than Willie, a lot bigger, and Willie had no idea how he could possibly have carried such a weight, but somehow he had, all the way to the clearing where Huey's like God's mercy had taken them off. "God bless you, Huey's. God bless. Oh, God bless you, every one." He had run to the clearing in the copters with bullets whicking all around him and body parts made in America lying on the trail where the mine or the booby trap or whatever the fuck it was had gone off. "I'm blind," he had screamed, carrying Sullivan, feeling Sullivan's blood drenching his uniform, and Sullivan had been screaming too. If Sullivan had stopped screaming, would Willie have simply rolled the man off his shoulder and gone on alone, trying to outrun the ambush? Probably not. Because by then he knew who Sullivan was, exactly who he was. He was Sully from the old hometown, Sully who had gone out with Carol Gerber from the old hometown. "I'm blind, I'm blind, I'm blind." That's what Willie Shearman was screaming as he toted Sullivan, and it's true that much of the world was blast white, but he still remembers seeing bullets twitch through leaves and thud into the trunks of trees. Remember seeing one of the men who had been in the ville earlier that day clap his hand to his throat. He remembers seeing the blood come bursting through that man's fingers in a flood, drenching his uniform. One of the other men from Delta Company 2-2, Pagano his name had been, grabbed this fellow around the middle and hustled him past the staggering Willie Shearman, who really couldn't see very much, screaming, "I'm blind, I'm blind, I'm blind," and smelling Sullivan's blood, the stink of it. And in the copter, that whiteness had started to come on strong. His face was burned, his hair was burned, his scalp was burned, the world was white. He was scorched and smoking, just one more escapee from Hell's Half Acre. He had believed he would never see again, and that had actually been a relief. But of course he had. In time, he had. The woman in the red blazer has reached him. "Can I help you, sir?" she asks.
"No, ma'am," Blind Willie says.
The ceaselessly moving cane stops tapping floor and quests over emptiness. It pendulums back and forth, mapping the sides of the staircase. Blind Willie nods, then moves carefully but confidently forward until he can touch the railing with the hand which holds the bulky case. He switches the case to his cane hand so he can grasp the railing, then turns toward the woman. He's careful not to smile directly at her, but a little to her left.
"No, thank you. I'm fine. Merry Christmas."
He starts downstairs, tapping ahead of him as he goes, big case held easily in spite of the cane. It's light, almost empty. Later, of course, it will be a different story. AM. Fifth Avenue is decked out for the holiday season. Glitter and finery he can barely see. Street lamps wear garlands of holly. The big stores have become garish Christmas packages, complete with gigantic red bows. A wreath, which must be 40 feet across, graces the staid beige facade of Brooks Brothers. Lights twinkle everywhere. In Saks' show window, a high-fashion mannequin, haughty fuck-you-jack expression, almost no tits or hips, sits astride a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. She is wearing a Santa hat, a fur-trimmed motorcycle jacket, thigh-high boots, and nothing else. Silver bells hang from the cycle's handlebars. Somewhere nearby, carolers are singing Silent Night. Not exactly Blind Willie's favorite tune, but a good deal better than Do You Hear What I Hear? He stops where he always stops, in front of St. Patrick's, across the street from Saks, allowing the package-laden shoppers to flood past in front of him. His movements now are simple and dignified. His discomfort in the men's room, that feeling of gawky nakedness about to be exposed, has passed. He never feels more Catholic than when he arrives on this spot. He was a St. Gabe's boy, after all. Wore the cross, wore the surplice, and took his turn as altar boy, knelt in the booth, ate the hated haddock on Fridays. He is in many ways still a St. Gabe's boy. All three versions of him have that in common. That part crossed the years and got over, as they used to say. Only these days he does penance instead of confession, and his certainty of heaven is gone. These days all he can do is hope. He squats, unlatches the case, and turns it so those approaching from uptown will be able to read the sticker on the top. Next, he takes out the third glove, the baseball glove he has had since the summer of 1960. He puts the glove beside the case. Nothing breaks more hearts than a blind man with a baseball glove, he has found. God bless America. Last but not least, he takes out the sign with its brave skirting of tinsel and ducks under the string. The sign comes to rest against the front of his field jacket. William J. Garfield, former U.S. Army, served Quang Tri, Toa Tien, Tam Boy, Ah Shao. Lost my sight, Dong Ha Province, 1970. Robbed of benefits by a grateful government, 1973. Lost home, 1975. Ashamed to beg, but have a son in school. Think well of me if you can. He raises his head so that the white light of this cold, almost ready to snow day slides across the blind bulbs of his dark glasses. Now the work begins, and it is harder work than anyone will ever know. There is a way to stand, not quite the military posture which is called parade rest, but close to it. The head must stay up, looking both at and through the people who pass back and forth in their thousands and tens of thousands. The hands must hang straight down in their black gloves, never fiddling with the sign or with the fabric of his pants or with each other. He must continue to project that sense of hurt, humbled pride. There must be no sense of shame or shaming, and most of all, no taint of insanity. He never speaks unless spoken to, and only then when he is spoken to in kindness. He does not respond to people who ask him angrily why he doesn't get a real job, or what he means about being robbed of his benefits. He does not argue with those who accuse him of fakery, or speak scornfully of a son who would allow his father to put him through school by begging on a street corner. He remembers breaking this ironclad rule only once, on a sweltering summer afternoon in 1981. "What school does your son go to?" a woman asked him angrily. He doesn't know what she looked like. By then it was 4 o'clock, and he had been as blind as a bat for at least 2 hours. But he had felt anger exploding out of her in all directions, like bedbugs exiting an old mattress. In a way, she had reminded him of Malenfant with his shrill, you-can't-not-hear-it voice. "Tell me which one. I want to mail him a dog turd."
"Don't bother," he replied, turning toward the sound of her voice. "If you've got a dog turd you want to mail somewhere, send it to LBJ. Federal Express must deliver to hell. They deliver every place else."
"God bless you, man," a guy in a cashmere overcoat says, and his voice trembles with surprising emotion. Except blind Willie Garfield isn't surprised. He's heard it all, he reckons, and a bit more. A surprising number of his customers put their money carefully and reverently in the pocket of the baseball glove. The guy in the cashmere coat drops his contribution into the open case, however, where it properly belongs. A 5. The workday has begun. 10:45 a.m. So far, so good. He lays his cane down carefully, drops to one knee, and dumps the contents of the baseball glove into the box. Then he sweeps a hand back and forth through the bills, although he can still see them pretty well. He picks them up. There's $400 or $500 in all, which puts him on the way to a $3,000 day. Not great for this time of year, but not bad either. Then rolls them up and slips a rubber band around them. He then pushes a button on the inside of the case, and the false floor drops down on springs, dumping the load of change all the way to the bottom. He adds the roll of bills, making no attempt to hide what he's doing, but feeling no qualms about it either. In all the years he has been doing this, no one has ever taken him off. God help the asshole whoever tries. He lets go of the button, allowing the false floor to snap back into place, and stands up. A hand immediately presses into the small of his back. "Merry Christmas, Willie," the owner of the hand says. Blind Willie recognizes him by the smell of his cologne. "Merry Christmas, Officer Wheelock," Willie responds. His head remains tilted upward in a faintly questioning posture. His hands hang at his sides. His feet, in their brightly polished boots, remain apart in a stance not quite wide enough to be parade rest, but nowhere near tight enough to pass as attention. "How are you today, sir?" "In the pink, motherfucker," Wheelock says. "You know me. Always in the pink." Here comes a man in a top coat hanging open over a bright red ski sweater. His hair is short, black on top, gray on the sides. His face has a stern, carved look Blind Willie recognizes at once. He's got a couple of handle-top bags, one from Saks, one from Bally, in his hands. He stops and reads the sign. "Dong Ha?" he asks suddenly, speaking not as a man does when naming a place, but as one does when recognizing an old acquaintance on a busy street.
"Yes, sir," Blind Willie says.
"Who is your CO? "Captain Bob Brissom, with a U, not an O, and above him, Colonel Andrew Shelf, sir."
"I heard of Shelf," says the man in the open coat.
His face suddenly looks different. As he walked toward the man on the corner, it looked as if it belonged on Fifth Avenue. Now it doesn't.
Never met him, though?
Toward the end of my run, we didn't see anyone with much rank, sir.
If you came out of the Ashau Valley, I'm not surprised. Are we on the same page here, soldier?
Yes, sir. There wasn't much command structure left by the time we hit Dong Ha. I pretty much rolled things along with another lieutenant. His name was Diefenbaker. The man in the red ski sweater is nodding slowly.
You boys were there when those helicopters came down, if I've got this placed right.
That's affirmative, sir.
Then you must have been there later when...
Blind Willie does not help him finish. He can smell Wheelock's cologne, though, stronger than ever, and the man is practically panting in his ear, sounding like a horny kid at the end of a hot date. Wheelock has never bought his act, and although Blind Willie pays for the privilege of being left alone on this corner, and quite handsomely by going rates, he knows that part of Wheelock is still cop enough to hope he'll fuck up. Part of Wheelock is actively rooting for that. But the Wheelocks of the world never understand that what looks fake isn't always fake. Sometimes the issues are a little more complicated than they appear at first glance. That was something else Vietnam had to teach him back in the years before it became a political joke and a crutch for hack film writers.
69 and 70 were the hard years, the graying man says. He speaks in a slow, heavy voice. I was at Hamburger Hill with the 3-187, so I know the Ah Chau and Tam Boy. Do you remember Route 922?
Yes, sir, Glory Road, Blind Willie says. I lost two friends there.
Glory Road, the man in the open coat says, and all at once he looks 1,000 years old, the bright red ski sweater in obscenity, like something hung on a museum mummy by cut-up kids who believe they are exhibiting a sense of humor. His eyes are off over 100 horizons. Then they come back here to this street where a nearby carillon is playing the one that goes, I hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring-ting-tingling, too. He sets his bags down between his expensive shoes and takes a pigskin wallet out from an inner pocket. He opens it, riffles through a neat thickness of bills. Son all right, Garfield? He asks. Making good grades?
Yes, sir.
How old?
15, sir.
Public school?
Parochial, sir.
Excellent. And God willing, he'll never see Glory fucking Road.
The man in the open topcoat takes a bill out of his wallet. Blind Willie feels as well as hears Wheelock's little gasp, and hardly has to look at the bill to know it is 100.
Yes, sir, that's affirmative, God willing.
The man in the topcoat touches Willie's hand with the bill, looks surprised when the gloved hand pulls back, as if it were bare and had been touched by something hot. Put it in my case or my ball glove, sir, if you would. Blind Willie says. The man in the top coat looks at him for a moment, eyebrows raised, frowning slightly, then seems to understand. He stoops, puts the bill in the ancient oiled pocket of the glove with Garfield printed in blue ink on the side, then reaches into his front pocket and brings out a small handful of change. This he scatters across the face of old Ben Franklin in order to hold the bill down. Then he stands up. His eyes are wet and bloodshot.
Do you any good to give you my card? He asks Blind Willie. I can put you in touch with several veterans organizations.
Thank you, sir. I'm sure you could, but I must respectfully decline.
Tried most of them?
Tried some, yes, sir.
Where'd you VA?
San Francisco, sir. He hesitates, then adds, the Pussy Palace, sir. The man in the top coat laughs heartily at this. And when his face crinkles, the tears which have been standing in his eyes run down his weathered cheeks.
Pussy Palace, he cries. I haven't heard that in 10 years. A bedpan under every bed and a naked nurse between every set of sheets, right? Naked except for the love beads, which they left on.
Yes, sir, that about covers it, sir.
Or uncovers it. Merry Christmas, soldier.
The man in the top coat ticks off a little one-finger salute. Merry Christmas to you, sir. The man in the top coat picks up his bags again and walks off. He doesn't look back. Blind Willie would not have seen him do so if he had. His vision is now down to ghosts and shadows.
"That was beautiful," Wheelock murmurs.
The feeling of Wheelock's freshly used air puffing into the cup of his ear is hateful to Blind Willie, gruesome in fact. But he will not give the man the pleasure of moving his head so much as an inch.
"The old fuck was actually crying, as I'm sure you saw. But you can talk the talk, Willie. I'll give you that much."
Willie says nothing. "Some VA hospital called the Pussy Palace, huh?" Wheelock asks.
"Sounds like my kind of place. Where'd you read about it, Soldier of Fortune?"
The shadow of a woman, a dark shape in a darkening day, bends over the open case and drops something in. A gloved hand touches Willie's gloved hand and squeezes briefly.
"God bless you, my friend," she says.
"Thank you, ma'am." The shadow moves off. The little puffs of breath in Blind Willie's ear do not.
"You got something for me, pal?" Wheelock asks.
Blind Willie reaches into his jacket pocket. He produces the envelope and holds it out, jabbing the chilly air with it. It is snatched from his fingers as soon as Wheelock can track it down and get hold of it.
"You asshole!"
There's fear as well as anger in the cop's voice.
"How many times have I told you? Palm it! Palm it!"
Blind Willie says nothing. He is thinking of the baseball glove, how he erased Bobby Garfield, as well as you could erase ink from leather anyway, and then printed Willie Shearman's name in its place. Later, after Vietnam and just as he was starting his new career, he erased a second time and printed a single name, Garfield, in big block letters. The place on the side of the old Alvin Dark glove where all these changes have been made looks flayed and raw. If he thinks of the glove, if he concentrates on that scuffed place and its layer of names, he can probably keep from doing something stupid. That's what Wheelock wants, of course. What he wants a lot more than his shitty little payoff, for Willie to do something stupid, to give himself away.
"How much?" Wheelock asks after a moment.
$300, Blind Willie says. $300, Officer Wheelock. This is greeted by a little thinking silence, but Wheelock takes a step back from Blind Willie, and the puffs of breath in his ear diffuse a little. Blind Willie is grateful for small favors.
"That's okay," Wheelock says at last, "this time.
But a new year's coming, pal. And your friend Jasper the police smurf has a piece of land in upstate New York that he wants to build a little cabana on. You capiche? The price of poker is going up."
Blind Willie says nothing, but he is listening very, very carefully now.
If this were all would be well. But Wheelock's voice suggests it isn't all.
"Actually, the cabana isn't the important part," Wheelock goes on.
"The important thing is I need a little better compensation if I have to deal with a low-life fuck like you." Genuine anger is creeping into his voice. "How you can do this every day, even at Christmas? Man, I don't know. People who beg, that's one thing. But a guy like you, you're no more blind than I am."
"Oh, you're lots blinder than me," Blind Willie thinks, but still he holds his peace.
"And you're doing okay, aren't you? Probably not as good as those PTL fucks on the tube, but you must clear, what, $1,000 a day this time of year? $2,000?
He is way low, but the miscalculation is music to Blind Willie Garfield's ears.
It means that his silent partner is not watching him too closely or too frequently. Not yet, anyway. But he doesn't like the anger in Wheelock's voice. Anger is like a wild card in a poker game.
"You're no more blind than I am," Wheelock repeats.
Apparently, this is the part that really gets him. "Hey, pal, you know what? I ought to follow you some night when you get off work, you know? See what you do." He pauses. "Who you turn into?"
For a moment, Blind Willie actually stops breathing. Then he starts again.
"You wouldn't want to do that, Officer Wheelock," he says.
"I wouldn't, huh? Why not, Willie? Why not? You looking out for my welfare, is that it?
Afraid I might kill a shit-ass who lays the golden eggs? Hey, what I get from you in the course of a year ain't all that much when you weigh it against a commendation, maybe a promotion. He pauses. When he speaks again, his voice has a dreamy quality which Willie finds especially alarming. I could be in the Post. Hero cop busts heartless scam artist on Fifth Avenue. Jesus, Willie thinks. Good Jesus, he sounds serious. Says Garfield on your glove there, but I'd bet Garfield ain't your name. I'd bet dollars to donuts. That's a bet you'd lose. Says you, but the side of that glove looks like it's seen more than one name written there. It was stolen when I was a kid. Is he talking too much? It's hard to say. Wheelock has managed to catch him by surprise, the bastard. First the phone rings while he's in his office, good old Ed from 9X. And now this. The boy who stole it from me wrote his name in it while he had it. When I got it back, I erased his and put mine on again. And it went to Vietnam with you? Yes. It's the truth. If Sullivan had seen that battered Alvin Dark fielder's mitt, would he have recognized it as his old friend Bobby's? Unlikely, but who could know? Sullivan never had seen it, not in the green at least, which made the whole question moot. Officer Jasper Wheelock, on the other hand, was posing all sorts of questions, and none of them were moot. Went to this Achu Valley with you, did it? Blind Willie doesn't reply. Wheelock is trying to lead him on now, and there's no place Wheelock can lead that Willie Garfield wants to go. Went to this tomboy place with you? Willie says nothing. Man, I thought a tomboy was a chick that liked to climb trees. Willie continues to say nothing. The Post, Wheelock says, and Willie dimly sees the asshole raise his hands slightly apart, as if framing a picture. Hero cop. He might just be teasing, but Willie can't tell. You'd be in the Post, all right. But there wouldn't be any commendation, Blind Willie says. No promotion, either. In fact, you'd be out on the street, Officer Wheelock, looking for a job. You could skip applying for one with security companies, though. A man who'll take a payoff can't be bonded. It is Wheelock's turn to stop breathing. When he starts again, the puffs of breath in Blind Willie's ear have become a hurricane. The cop's moving mouth is almost on his skin. What do you mean? He whispers. A hand settles on the arm of Blind Willie's field jacket. You just tell me what the fuck you mean. But Blind Willie continues silent, hands at his sides, head slightly raised, looking attentively into the darkness that will not clear until daylight is almost gone, and on his face is that lack of expression which so many passers-by read as ruined pride, courage brought low but somehow still intact. Better be careful, Officer Wheelock, he thinks. The ice under you is getting thin. I may be blind, but you must be deaf if you can't hear the sound of it cracking under your feet. The hand on his arm shakes him slightly. Wheelock's fingers are digging in. You got a friend? Is that it, you son of a bitch? Is that why you hold the envelope out that way half the damn time? You got a friend taking my picture? Is that it? Blind Willie goes on saying nothing. To Jasper the police smurf, he is now giving a sermon of silence. People like Officer Wheelock will always think the worst if you let them. You only have to give them time to do it.
You don't want to fuck with me, pal, Wheelock says viciously.
But there is a subtle undertone of worry in his voice, and the hand on Blind Willie's jacket loosens. We're going up to 400 a month starting in January, and if you try playing any games with me, I'm going to show you where the real playground is. You understand me? Blind Willie says nothing. The puffs of air stop hitting his ear, and he knows Wheelock is getting ready to go. But not yet, alas. The nasty little puffs come back.
You'll burn in hell for what you're doing, Wheelock tells him.
He speaks with great, almost fervent sincerity.
What I'm doing when I take your dirty money is a venial sin. I ask the priest, so I'm sure. But yours is mortal. You're going to hell. See how many handouts you get down there.
Blind Willie thinks of a jacket Willie and Bill Shearman sometimes see on the street. There is a map of Vietnam on the back, usually the years the wearer of the jacket spent there, and this message. When I die, I'm going straight to heaven, because I spent my time in hell. He could mention this sentiment to Officer Wheelock, but it would do no good. Silence is better. Wheelock walks away, and Willie's thought that he's glad to see him go causes a rare smile to touch his face. It comes and goes like an errant ray of sunshine on a cloudy day. 1:40 p.m. Three times he has banded the bills into rolls and dumped the change into the bottom of the case. This is really a storage function and not an effort at concealment. Now working completely by touch, he can no longer see the money, doesn't know a one from a hundred, but he senses he is having a very good day indeed. There is no pleasure in the knowledge, however. There's never much. Pleasure is not what Blind Willie is about, but even the sense of accomplishment he might have felt on another day has been muted by his conversation with Officer Wheelock. At 11:45, a young woman with a pretty voice, to Blind Willie she sounds like Diana Ross, comes out of Saks and gives him a cup of hot coffee, as she does most days at this time. At 11:15, another woman, this one not so young and probably white, brings him a cup of steaming chicken noodle soup. He thanks them both. The white lady kisses his cheek with soft lips and wishes him the merriest of Merry Christmases. There is a counterbalancing side to the day, though. There almost always is. Around 1:00, a teenage boy with his unseen gang of buddies, laughing and joking and skylarking all around him, speaks out of the darkness to Blind Willie's left, says he is one ugly motherfuck, then asks if he wears those gloves because he burned his fingers off trying to read the waffle iron. He and his friends charge off, howling with laughter at this ancient jape. 15 minutes or so later, someone kicks him, although that might have been an accident. Every time he bends over to the case, however, the case is right there. It is a city of hustlers, muggers, and thieves, but the case is right there, just as it has always been, right there. And through it all, he thinks about Wheelock. The cop before Wheelock was easy. The one who comes when Wheelock either quits the force or gets moved out of Midtown may also be easy. Wheelock will shake, bake, or flake eventually. That's something else he learned in the bush, and in the meantime, he, Blind Willie, must bend like a reed in a windstorm. Except even the limberest reed breaks if the wind blows hard enough. Wheelock wants more money, but that isn't what bothers the man in the dark glasses in the army coat. Sooner or later, they all want more money. When he started on this corner, he paid Officer Hanratty $125. Hanratty was a live-and-let-live type of guy who smelled of Old Spice and whiskey, just like George Raymer, the neighborhood beat cop of Willie Shearman's childhood. But easygoing Eric Hanratty'd still had Blind Willie up to $200 a month by the time he retired in 1978. And the thing is, dig it, my brothers, Wheelock was angry this morning, angry, and Wheelock talked about having consulted a priest. These things worry him. But what worries him most of all is what Wheelock said about following him. See what you do, who you turn into. Garfield ain't your name. I'd bet dollars to donuts. It's a mistake to fuck with the truly penitential, Officer Wheelock. Blind Willie thinks, you'd be safer fucking with my wife than with my name. Believe me, safer by far. Wheelock could do it, though. What could be simpler than shadowing a blind man, or even one who can see a little more than shadows? Simpler than watching him turn into some hotel and enter the public men's room? Watching him go into a stall as Blind Willie Garfield and come out as Willie Shearman? Suppose Wheelock was even able to back trail him from Willie to Bill? Thinking this brings back his morning jitters, his feeling of being a snake between skins. The fear that he has been photographed taking a bribe will hold Wheelock for a while, but if he is angry enough, there is no predicting what he may do, and that is scary. "God love you, soldier," says a voice out of the darkness. "I wish I could do more." "Not necessary, sir," Blind Willie says, but his mind is still on Jasper Wheelock, who smells of cheap cologne and talked to a priest about the blind man with the sign, the blind man who is not, in Wheelock's opinion, blind at all. What did he say? "You're going to hell. See how many handouts you get down there." "Have a very Merry Christmas, sir. Thank you for helping me." And the day goes on. p.m. His sight has started to resurface, dim, distant, but there. It is his cue to pack up and go. He kneels, back ramrod stiff, and lays his cane behind the case again. He bands the last of the bills, dumps them and the last coins into the bottom of the case, then puts the baseball glove and the tinsel-decorated sign inside. He latches the case and stands up, holding his cane in the other hand. Now the case is heavy, dragging at his arm with the dead weight of all that well-meant metal. There is a heavy rattling crunch as the coins avalanche into a new position, and then they are as still as ore plugged deep in the ground. He sets off down Fifth, dangling the case at the end of his left arm like an anchor. After all these years, he's used to the weight of it, could carry it much farther than he'll need to this afternoon, if circumstances demanded. Holding the cane in his right hand and tapping it delicately on the paving in front of him, the cane is magic, opening a pocket of empty space before him on the crowded, jostling sidewalk in a teardrop-shaped wave. By the time he gets to Fifth and 43rd, he can actually see this space. He can also see the "Don't Walk" sign at 42nd stop flashing and hold solid, but he keeps walking anyway, letting a well-dressed man with long hair and gold chains reach out and grasp his shoulder to stop him.
"Watch it, my man," the long hair says. "Traffic's on the way."
"Thank you, sir," Blind Willie says.
"Don't mention it. Merry Christmas."
Blind Willie crosses, passes the lion standing sentry at the public library, and goes down two more blocks where he turns towards 6th Avenue. No one accosts him. No one has loitered, watching him collect all day long and then followed, waiting for the opportunity to bag the case and run. Not that many thieves could run with it, not this case. Once, back in the summer of 79, two or three young guys, maybe black, he couldn't say for sure. They sounded black, but his vision had been slow returning that day. It was always slower in warm weather, when the days stayed bright longer. Had accosted him and begun talking to him in a way he didn't quite like. It wasn't like the kids this afternoon, with their jokes about reading the waffle iron and what does a Playboy centerfold look like in Braille. It was softer than that, and in some weird fashion, almost kind. Questions about how much he took in by St. Pat's back there, and would he perchance be generous enough to make a contribution to something called the Polo Recreational League, and did he want a little protection getting to his bus stop or train station or whatever? One, perhaps a budding sexologist, had asked if he liked a little young pussy once in a while. "It pep you up," the voice on his left said softly, almost longingly. "Yes, sir, you must believe that shit." He had felt the way he imagined a mouse must feel when the cat is just pawing at it, claws not out yet, curious about what the mouse will do and how fast it can run and what sorts of noises it will make as its terror grows. Blind Willie had not been terrified, however. Scared, Yes, indeed, you could fairly say he had been scared, but he has not been out-and-out terrified since his last week in the Green, the week that had begun in the Ah Chao Valley and ended in Dong Ha, the week the Viet Cong had harried them steadily west at what was not quite a full retreat, at the same time pinching them on both sides, driving them like cattle down a chute, always yelling from the trees,